This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publicize your book. And there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Good afternoon, and welcome back to the New Books Podcast in Eastern European Studies. I'm your host, Piotr Kosicki. I'm a professor of history at the University of Maryland in College Park. Joining me today is Anna Machcewicz, author of the book Civility in Uncivil Times, Kazimierz Mocarski's Quiet Battle for Truth, From the Polish Underground to Stalinist Prison, which was published in late 2020 by Peter Lang. This is the first English language edition of Machcewicz's biography of Kazimierz Mocarski, a powerful case study of some of the extreme ethical, political, and human dilemmas faced in the history of 20th century Eastern Europe. Mocarski became a major figure in the Polish underground state in the final months of World War II, but he is best known for sharing a cell in post-war Stalinist prison with SS General Jürgen Strop, liquidator of the Warsaw Ghetto. After serving one of the longest prison terms in the history of communist Poland, 11 years, Mocarski reconstructed his conversations in forensic detail in a book published posthumously under the death Conversations with an Execution. Now, our guest, Anna Machcewicz, is assistant professor in the Institute of Political Studies of the Polish Academy of Sciences in Warsaw, as well as a past research fellow at both Yale University and the Imre Kertész Kolleg in Jena. She is a very accomplished author and historian and very influential in several different circles of Polish historical writing. Aside from her biography of Mocarski, she is also the author of a beautifully written and much lauded study of the genesis of solidarity in August 1980, entitled Bunt, or Rebellion, which I understand is in the process of being translated. Professor Machcewicz, welcome.
Welcome. You're welcome, everybody.
Thank you so much for joining us. If I may ask to start the conversation, since some of our audience probably has never heard of Kazimierz Mocarski before, could you please say a few words about why you chose to write a book about him?
This life story, Mocarski, was, I would say, another. For years, Mocarski was known as the author of his only book about Strop. It was a very important book, but his own biography was unexplored, was hidden. And when the communist secret service, communist secret police archive was opened in Poland, I found interesting files regarding him. there were protocols of interrogation, trials, documents, reports submitted secretly by a person Muchalski trusted. Very interesting, personal, very touching materials. Materials from his surveillance after releasing. His wife was harassed by the security service, which tried to discredit his name. Additionally, thanks to Moczarski's daughter, I received the access to his personal archive. There were also documents, memoirs, letters, personal letters, letters from prison. Reading all this, I have met a fascinated story of life in a difficult time and a really exceptional character for a book. So it was the decision how I must write it.
It makes perfect sense, and it's a very compelling story on so many levels. May I ask, just for our international audience, some folks might wonder if you would describe Moczarski now from the perspective of having written the book and having put it down and had time afterwards since its publication to think. Would you call him a historian first? Would you call him a martyr or someone who suffered for a cause, a resistance fighter? For an audience that maybe doesn't necessarily focus above all on Poland, how should they place him historically?
I would say never a resistance fighter nor a martyr for a cause. He wasn't a typical resistance fighter because he didn't touch a gun during the war. Under the German occupation, Moczarski did his best as a citizen of the underground state. But not coincidentally, he was rational. He had a very strong personality, but he wasn't a heroic type at all. I even think that he would have protested against the word of a martyr. He didn't like the grand words.
This is actually, I think, a wonderful entry point to thinking about where his own approach to civic engagement came from. Something that struck me when I was reading the book, especially in the first chapters, is the importance of the legacy of 19th century struggles for Polish nationhood and Polish identity. For those who studied Polish history, the term organic work might be familiar, or positivism. Weighed for Moczarski half a century later, when he was working on behalf of the Polish underground state. So let me ask you, is that assumption even founded, well-founded on my part? Does it make sense to think about the 19th century when we think about Moczarski in the middle of the 20th century? And in that sense, I appreciate what you said, that he would have not liked the word martyr at all. But where might he have placed himself relative to the earlier generations in terms of trying to keep Poland sovereign and alive?
Responding to, this is a very long question.
Sorry about that.
Responding to the first part about the legacy of January uprising. And so Moczarski was 11. He was a child when the Polish Republic was reborn after partition. And he was one of the first generation who started its adult life in it. He became active in public life as his parents were in the late of 19th century, just as a university student. his engagement was rooted in this late 19th century ethical tradition of the radical intelligentsia devoted to build an independent state. The independent state in the beginning of 20th century was very fresh, very young. This link between both the underground state existing during the January uprising and German occupation shows the same pattern of understanding of civil duty. The people, the intelligentsia from the second part of 19th century fought for independent state, and the generation of Mocharski was faced to the same during the Second World War. Why was the Polish underground state built? The main goal was to consolidate and lead the Polish society through this darkness of the education. This is the main goal, I would say. Yes. Second, Mocharski became a member of a very important cell, the Office of Information and Propaganda. It was a very specific place. It assembled the Polish intellectual elite, university scholars, sociologists, historians, economists, and lawyers. They served for the authorities, for the underground authorities in Poland and abroad for Polish government in exile. The reports they produced became the most reliable source of information about the political opinion, about the social life in the occupied country. It was a conspirational think tank, I would say. In the last month of the occupation, of German occupation, after the Warsaw Uprising, when the chief of his office was arrested by German, Mocharski took his place and rose from a relatively low level in the military hierarchy. He continued in that position after the Red Army entered the Polish lands. But the war still was going. And in that moment, it seemed not pointless. Yes? And the Yalta conferences of February 1944, the Allies agreed to sponsor democratic election in Poland. And everything was open, still open.
Yeah, it's difficult to inhabit the space of mid-1945 without falling into a measure of despair, I think, because obviously we know what happened, and we know what happened specifically to Mocharski, and your book sketches that in brutal and very empathetic detail. I should underscore for the audience that it's a beautifully written and beautifully translated book that really evoke the different dimensions of Mocharski's experience and context. The way you described this moment of exiting from war into the post-Yalta moment, I'm struck thinking also of that, your other great description from what you were just saying, a conspiratorial think tank. Mocharski was part of a think tank type environment. Is it possible? Can we imagine? It's a thought experiment, obviously, but would it even make sense to imagine him as a participant in the kind of popular front politics, shall we call them, of the first 2 years after World War II, when it seemed like maybe there might be a space for someone other than activists of the Polish Workers' Party, later the Polish United Workers' Party? He, in your book, comes off quite as a man of the left. He's clearly not a man of the right, even though his politics maybe are unclear, maybe complicated, maybe just never had the opportunity to develop fully. Can you imagine him as a political actor in the immediate post-war if he hadn't been arrested?
He was involved in politics since the late 30s. He was a member of the Democratic Movement just before the war. And during the war, he was a member of underground party, Democratic Party. The fate of this party was after war was rather sad, because it's true that some colleagues of him from the Democratic Party partially followed the Popular Front, and they later during the Stalinist era they lost their integrity. For me, it's of course difficult to predict what would happen with Moczarski, but I think that his political and ethical integrity was very deep, deeper than his political ambitions. So Moczarski, who was searching for his own ideology so long, from 30s, and finally he opted for the Democratic Movement. For him, it means that he opted to liberal, democratic, and secular state, but not an authoritarian. He was very sensitive to social injustice, but above all, he respected the law. He was a lawyer, and the social contract, but he wasn't in favor of the revolution. So I suppose that sooner or later he would be pushed out from the Popular Front or even arrested later.
Yeah, the notion of rule of law really dovetails very well with the portrait of his idea of civility as a lived day-to-day experience that comes out of your book. And that's partly also why the book, I think, really left me shaken. I mentioned to you earlier that this is a book that I think the largest possible audience can read and can walk away with a clear portrait of the brutality of the Stalinist era and the Stalinist political system, also the Stalinist carceral system, the reality of imprisonment. And it strikes me that the moment of your translations publication is very fortuitous, in that actually there's been some really interesting historical work in recent years taking new perspectives to the Stalinist security and carceral apparatus in Eastern Europe in the mid-20th century. I'm thinking of a couple of specific books, one by Anna Müller, That These Walls Could Talk, about women in Stalinist prisons, one by Molly Pucci, Security Empire, kind of bottom-up social history of the people who populated the secret police apparatus of several East Central European countries in the first decade of its existence. The question that I would pose to you, and it seems like a fairly maybe jarring transition from this notion of rule of law, but I think it underscores the disconnect, the dissonance that Moczarski must have felt even before the brutality of his imprisonment took root. How, instead of rule of law, he had to live physical beatings and physical, basically being consumed by a reality of torture on a daily basis. So the question that I would pose to you is, for him, was this a problem that spoke to Poland and how Poland had lost rule of law? Or do you think it actually reflects the Soviet takeover And I think that's a bigger historiographical question where your book really fits in beautifully with some of the newer trends.
I would say that Mocharski's case is very Polish and very East European. It's a European, East European fate, two regimes and two occupation. The story shows how the subjection happened. Obviously, it was the Soviets who installed the communist regime in Poland. Without them, the fate of Mocharski and people like him would have been different, probably. Yes, we could have a democratic state. On the other hand, Mocharski was interrogated, tortured, and persecuted not by Soviet functionaries, by the Poles, by the people in Polish uniforms, but using Stalinist methods. So it's not a real independent state, of course. It's a very artificial creature, which for Mocharski, who was, as I said, who was who respected the law and expected the legal procedure, was non-understandable and even worse. Yes, so when he was released from the prison after 11 years, he demanded an honest trial, and he had it.
The question of his retrial, right, or the in other words, the difference between what you just described, his belief in rule of law leading him to demand a retrial, versus being amnesty. I think that's something that might not be entirely clear to our audience. And I think for Mocharski, this was, as you I think beautifully evoke, he was a lawyer. He understood the difference. He understood what he had experienced, and he wanted it to be acknowledged. And he also was released at a moment where, and you say this in your book, the window was very small for a kind of rule of law type of experience. Do you feel like he got what he was seeking? He was able to achieve some proof of rule of law?
He achieved. He was very stubborn, and he demanded and he achieved. It was his trial. His retrial was probably one of the one of the most famous trials during the fleet in Poland, and this trial really revealed many of Stalinist practices. Yes, so it was very important. As you said, it was a very small window, but very important. This window somehow closed a certain era, certain epoch. Yeah.
In some sense, for me, then, Mocharski is the embodiment of the kind of rise and fall of Stalinism in so many ways. And I think that's also, it's one of many stories that come through very clearly in your book. But the way that these transitions are written from into the Stalinist period, out of the Stalinist period, it strikes me that it must have been very difficult for you conceptualizing. And I mean, I think the result is extraordinarily powerful and really, really smooth. The difference between writing about someone fighting underground, and then writing about political imprisonment, and then writing about the return to freedom. In the sense also the source materials are different, and the psychology is different. Did you have to write these at different times. I have a hard time imagining them being written one after another after another, because your own psychology must have been affected as you were writing this.
You know, I've written this book very quickly, and I would say that I've written one chapter and another chapter without any break. For me, it was simply the same person. Yes, it was a journey. It was I felt like I would take a journey with somebody, journey through his life, join him, and I joined him and observed, yes, and observed, tried to understand him, follow him, yes. I tried to follow him, his decisions, his perspectives, his pain, his lost, this horrible story of his marriage, which was devastated because I can mention that also his wife was arrested for six and condemned for 6 years. So they were released and they tried to reconstruct, to save their marriage after 11 years. So it's another price of being a political prisoner. So this story have so many dimensions to read that this is, I would say, this is not only East European story. I think that it could be touching for everybody who is looking a testimony how to survive tough times and survive successfully even the obstacle looked so not possible to survive. Yeah.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com, code POD.
Well, that's it. I mean, his story is so brutal in so many ways. I love your description, though. And I think partly when I was reading this the last time, I was making notes to myself for my own teaching purposes. I have students sometimes who want to write biographical history. And biographical history is difficult, partly for the reason you outline. You really have to inhabit the space, the mental space, to the extent possible, of the protagonist of your story. But you also have to maintain the critical distance and speak to more than just the significance of one man or woman, right? In that sense, the particular in this case is really powerful, but we also seek, if not the universal, then at least something broader or more general. And I agree with you that Mocharski's story does speak beyond Poland, beyond Eastern Europe. The one way of thinking about this strikes me.
If I may, I would add that for me, the story is very brutal and sad and very painful, but also very optimistic to some extent, because he until the end he tried to be a happy person. Yes, he lived with around many friends. His family. He tried to work, and finally he has written a book which was important for him. He survived, and he gave a testimony. Yeah.
I'm glad you brought up the book that he wrote. Obviously, this is a book, and I mean Mocharski's book, that has existed in the international realm for decades at this point. I forget how many languages it was translated
14,
into.
14, I think.
Well, that's it. And I think it's been available in English
more than 10. No, it's available in English, French, German, Japanese, Ukrainian lately, Greek.
Brilliant.
Italian, so Russian even. Yeah.
Mocharski's experience. Sorry, go ahead. Yeah.
Russian even, finally. Yeah.
Well, that already says something. That already says something.
Yes.
Mocharski's experience with SS General Strupp is well known. And in that sense, I think one of the great things also that comes of your book, and something I wanted to ask you, is how we place what we know from reading Mocharski into the context of his biography. You describe in your introduction to your book, the book that Mocharski wrote, Conversations with an Executioner, as a vivisection of a killer. And one of the concepts that you bring in, and makes perfect sense, is Hannah Arendt's concept of the banality of evil. I think historians, not just of the Holocaust, but more generally of the 20th century, have been conflicted in recent decades about Hannah Arendt's concept, in the sense that they worry, and in some cases are quite convinced, that it somewhat absolves Adolf Eichmann of a measure of responsibility. And in this particular instance, Mocharski got to know Strupp much better than obviously Hannah Arendt knew Eichmann. She didn't know him personally at all. But in that sense, then most people who would use the banality of evil concept would really be able to speak to their subjects as human beings. So I'm curious for you if, knowing Mocharski's story as well as you do, does banality of evil, in his case, if we can really use it to describe how he thought about Strupp, mean just that he wanted to humanize Strupp, or that understanding the executioner better really does in some way diminish individual responsibility?
Mocharski faced a criminal and the mortal enemy for the last 6 years, who was Strupp exactly. But in a cell, prisoners are even. And they simply talk. And during this very long conversation with Strupp, Mocharski wanted simply to know him, to understand, to not in order to absolve him, yes, but in order to understand how he became a Nazi. Mocharski sliced and diced Strupp and reconstructed his life with him, following him. And he discovered which he described in his book, that the sad truth is how easy it is to transform humans into beasts. Schlup was a very limited person, vain, thoughtlessly repeating slogans, nothing interesting in his personality, much as he couldn't fight. So he was banal, but obedient to the end, and ready to commit a crime without any hesitations. So Moczarski's analysis enhances or corresponds to Arendt's conclusion, I would say. But I would say they both were perfect cogs in the bureaucratic machine of totalitarian state, and they both are guilty. And Moczarski's book shows it in a very convincing way, I would say.
The experience, and obviously we know a lot about Schlup, both from Moczarski's book and from the records of his trial, from the trial itself. I'm curious, obviously we have the trial records for Moczarski, but you had mentioned that part of what attracted you to this subject was finding so much material about Moczarski. And I do want to stick with the question of how to write the story of imprisonment and torture somewhat, just because it is such a personal story, even though it speaks to much broader stakes. Partly because I think in general, a lot of historians of the communist period wrestle with this. Those who do it, let's say, less critically, will just kind of copy things from the files that they read. But that's not what you do at all. And I'm curious how you thought about the process of triangulating Moczarski's own reflections with what you found in his interrogation records or the other records of the secret police, with what you found in other sources. In other words, how did you know, or how did you get to the point where you had confidence that you really understood what he was feeling when he was being beaten and kicked repeatedly by Józef Różański or whomever?
Yeah. You know, it's the material produced by secret police are very sensitive. Yeah. But historians should be critical and distrustful to any kind of sources. So documents produced by security apparatus could be indeed misleading, but should be always confronted to another sources. If there are any doubts, historians should admit it and reveal it to the readers. I would give you an example. I found among these documents in IPN, in the archive of IPN, I found one very ambiguous. It was an agreement to cooperation signed by Moczarski in prison, in a very special circumstances, of course. It was only a copy. I didn't find any other proofs of cooperations, nothing. But I found it, and I couldn't to conceal it. So I've decided to write about it, and also I've written about all my doubts regarding these documents. I think that it was only honest way how I can manage with this problem, reveal and share my doubts. That's all, because I couldn't decide it was truth or not, it was false or not, I don't know. But I can show only all circumstances.
In that sense, also reflecting on what he said afterwards, I think really enhances and of course complicates the story. In some sense, I wonder still if it made it easier for him or harder to think about his own experience when he was writing Conversations with an Executioner. Because of course, he was partly focusing on himself. He had to be in order to write that book. Do you think it helped in terms of recovering from having been in prison, or it's hard to say in the end?
I think that writing a story of a sharp life story for Motarski, it was extreme experience because he had to hide himself. I think that he decided to delete somehow his presence from the story. It was to some extent it was because he probably didn't want to complicate the story so much, but also it was kind of self-limitation.
Censoring himself?
Yes,
do you think?
Yes, okay. I would say this because we have to remember that he still was living under communism, and he couldn't write the whole story openly. He couldn't write his part of story, why he was in the cell, yes, with Strop. In these times, communist times, people who read his book could only guess, yes, what happened to him. So, yes.
Well, I think that the way that you described just now, how he tried to pull himself back, but also dealt with certain realities. I'm thinking about the title of the book, but it's not just about the title, the civility and uncivil times, which I think it expresses very well what was going on in Motarski's sort of core ethical dilemmas. But for you, it's clear that he is a kind of beacon of civility, not in a kind of abstract philosophical way, but in a real, everyday, practical kind of way. And I'm curious, given what you were describing before, when we study Eastern Europe, we know about the problem of the dual totalitarianisms. But it's one thing to know about the big political picture, and it's another to think about how exactly people could respond, right? So would you consider that self-censorship you were describing, is that an example of trying to be civil? Or I guess my broader question is, would you say that this was this idea of trying to find an ethical way of life in circumstances where being ethical was very difficult? And I don't just mean in prison or underground, but in the face of censorship. is that something that guided everything he did? Or at the end of the day, did he really want the book to appear? And was that maybe a little bit more decisive when it came to deciding what to write or what not to write?
I'm not sure, of course. I can only guess that Motulski decided to write this book in this way, using self-censorship, because it was the only way to describe the story, and he was sure that he caught a great material, yes, like a journalist. He knows something very important, and it was more important to reveal it than to think about its censorship is not okay or it's okay. And you know, it's the decision to publish it, to prepare it, it's essential, it's substantial, and it was the other things are less important. So it's a civil decision, I would say. Yes, what is really important. Yeah.
This is a good moment, I think, maybe to reflect on Motulski's legacy. And in that sense, it speaks to the subsequent history of Poland, or even more generally to the region. Motulski obviously died in 1975. So there are so many things we can speculate about in terms of what he would have thought, what he would have seen, how he would have reacted. But one thing that, again, really struck me in the course of this reading of your book is just how scared or horrified or concerned he was by certain behaviors on the political far right. And in this sense, it's not even for me because he was a man of the left, but particularly the National Armed Forces, or NSZ for those in the audience who are more conversant in Polish affairs, Motulski comes out point blank and calls them pure fascists. And the NSZ have had a pretty good cultural afterlife in the 21st century, I have to say. I don't necessarily even want to talk specifically about the NSZ, but I'm curious how you feel Motulski would assess cultural memory of the two totalitarianisms today, because some formations have been lionized or glorified, and others have really been vilified in the extreme, especially anyone who's been paying attention to politics in the past 10 years will know the roundtable talks and the process that dismantled the communist regime. But just in terms of the groups that Motulski knew personally, how do we think, knowing what we know about Motulski, knowing what we know about how he tried to be civil, about the different options for politics of memory in 2021?
Mm. No, I think that the Second World War should have cured people once and for all on inflicting any form of persecution based on nationality and beliefs and so on. But we know that it haven't cured. And today, even in Europe, in many European countries, we have a wave of radical racist, anti-immigrant movements, not only in Poland, but in Germany, Sweden, French. But true is that democratic countries somehow struggle with this wave, more or less. But in Poland, we have a right-wing government doesn't, and he who finally supports our contemporary nationalists. At the same time, this government, using this history, is focused on history and presents as heroes people like Mochalski and the members of the National Armed Force together. It's a lie. It's a pure hypocrisy. And we can protest. We can say it's not true. And for example, in Poland, we have an award who have a name of Kazimierz Mochalski. We awarded historical books, and every year it is an opportunity to remind who he was, and so through education, through popularization, his name, his struggle. Not only Mochalski, but people like him. We can try to educate, to convince people, maybe we can stop this wave or not.
I certainly hope so. The education part, I can't underscore enough. And I'm so glad you have. For those in the audience who don't know the Mochalski Award, it is really one of the most prestigious awards for books about contemporary history awarded in Poland. So the name Mochalski shows up in the pages of the press.
Every year for 1 or 2 months when this information are released about nominations, it's really something, I think.
So I wanted to ask, now that we're moving into the final minutes of our interview, if you feel like sharing any news with our audience about your current projects. I know, obviously, that your book about the origins of Solidarność is being translated. What else are you working on? Because I'm sure our audience would love to know what they can look forward to.
I'm reading a new book about. I started many a couple of years ago. I started a new project which described prison system, but in Poland during Stalinism, but from different way, not as a place of post-war retribution or political and ideological repressions or mass-scale terror, because these functions have already been researched. Instead of that, I like to focus on the dimension of everyday life in the prisons, how people how functions in a close prison microcosm, but in this certain authoritarian reality. So I'm going to analyze the mutual influences of individuals and groups within one cell, the rituals, the connections between the connection between inmates and overseers. So this is a quite broad microcosm, very special, but this experience, prison experience, was a shaped a considerable part of the post-war generation in Poland, in East Europe. So I think that it's interesting to describe what these people experience and who they were after releasing. Yeah.
That is an incredibly timely approach, I think, this sort of cultural history of imprisonment. And clearly it's a perfect follow-up to what you wrote or to the approach that you took to Motarski's biography. I'm glad you brought up also the more general element for Eastern Europe. I think that may be my last question. How would you situate, I know that you haven't finished the book yet, obviously, but just in your preliminary conclusions, how would you situate Poland on this particular point with respect to the rest of the bloc?
In this prison, I try to focus not only from the political point of view, but I from the anthropological point of view. So I try to describe this people not as a victim of communism, but a victim of total institutions, but under a total regime. So I am focusing more on this anthropological experience than political. The differences between Poland, for example, and Soviet Russia is very substantial. One of them is that in Poland we have prisons, and Russia they have gulags, they have camp works. We haven't. So this is different experience, and I also tried in my book tried to answer why Polish communists didn't buy a system of gulag in Poland, because they didn't. Yeah.
I can't wait to read the book. And let me just say that I think that this is a wonderful project. And as I mentioned earlier, really just such an important follow-up in a scholarly conversation that's really very current right now for a lot of reasons. I want to thank Professor Machcewicz for joining us today on the New Books in Eastern European Studies podcast. If I may once again offer my most wholehearted and warmest recommendation to our audience that you get your hands on a copy of Civility in Uncivil Times, Kazimierz Motarski's Quiet Battle for Truth, From the Polish Underground to Stalinist Prison, published last year by Peter Lang. Professor Machcewicz, thank you so much for joining me and for speaking with us.
Thank you very much, too.
Thank you to everyone, and once again, thanks for joining and listening in to New Books in Eastern European Studies. Have a good afternoon.